Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Arthur C. He's the author, most recently, of The Redshifting Web, which is published by Copper Canyon Press. And it is a collection of his poems from 1970 to 1998. This is basically all the books, selections from the early books and the complete texts of the most recent books, as well as new poems. I'm sitting in Santa Fe in the Literary Library of the Lannan Foundation. Arthur C. is a Lannan Prize winner, and really over the last several years has been awarded most of the prestigious prizes and grants that the poetry world has to offer. He has been living in Santa Fe for the last, how long is it, Arthur?
26 years.
And teaching variously around New Mexico. And what are the auspices that teaching has occurred under?
Well, I came to New Mexico in 1972, and for 10 years, from 1973 to 83, I worked as a poet in the schools through the New Mexico Arts Division. And because I had never lived in New Mexico before, I stumbled into a job that I was offered to be a visiting poet. I got to work all over the state. I worked wherever they sent me, and it was an incredible way to experience the diversity of New Mexico. I worked at the state pen. I worked with women in the prison. I worked with men in maximum security. At one point, I worked on death row. Through the bars of a cell, I would sit down on that cold cement floor and through the cell bars do an individual poetry workshop. I worked at the New Mexico School for the Deaf, if you can believe it, and I had a sign translator who took my words and translated them into sign language, and deaf students wrote poems and signed their poems. I worked at Santo Domingo Pueblo, Jemez Pueblo, Taos Pueblo. I worked at Los Alamos High School with children of scientists. I worked at Carlsbad. So I worked all over the state. And the other thing I want to say is, starting in 1984, I've taught at the Institute of American Indian Arts, which is a two-year college, federally funded, and there are 100 students from all over the country, but they represent 70 tribes across the United States.
Now, you are, in fact, Chinese-American. Is there this diversity and multicultural conversation that goes on in the act of teaching? Do you experience as a teacher, I can imagine someone on death row saying, what do you know that enables you to talk to me? Or for that matter, as I understand it, within the Indian Institute, there are families, tribes, where the students have been taught to fear one another. And so conversation seems to be, at the very least, problematic. How did you learn to overcome the obstacles of experiences that are not shared?
I think it's an ongoing challenge. I feel that teaching is a genuine exchange, so that a lot of it involves genuinely listening and hearing. It's something that we don't often do, frankly, as well as sort of sharing who we are. And I think I, as a Chinese American, in terms of my background, I bring a kind of complexity of experience that people I work with recognize. And there's just in the interchange of attention, I don't know how else to explain it.
Now, let's begin with the title of this collection, which has come out just this year from Copper Canyon Press, The Redshifting Web. And I immediately want to begin by asking you what redshifting means, what it is.
Redshift is a term from astronomy or astrophysics. If you think of the Earth moving, and basically, you know, every writer has his or her obsessions, and one of mine has to do with, You can go all the way back to Heraclitus and say everything is in flux, everything is flowing. You cannot step into the same river twice. Redshift has to do with the fact that the Earth, that the galaxy, is moving. And other constellations, other galaxies, are also moving relative to the Earth. And if they're moving further away relative to how the Earth is moving, the light from those galaxies bends, and it undergoes a shift toward the longer wavelength, toward the red end of the spectrum. A galaxy heading toward the Earth is going to undergo what's called blue shift. But I was obsessed with the image of the expanding universe, which is the red shift. And I also am obsessed with how things connect, and that's the image of a web. So, and for me, even though it's not directly stated, it's an image of a spider, of a poet, of an artist who creates. Whitman has an image, for instance, of a spider who's creating a web. A contemporary poet like A.R. Ammons has a wonderful poem called Identity, where a spider is looking for the perfect place to put a web and can't find it. I like to make connections between the very large, the very cosmic, which is the redshift, and yet not to exclude the very minute, very particular, which is the image of the web. So I see the title as containing many of the obsessions and paradoxes that fascinate me as a poet.
Well, it seems to me, and this is something I like to stress on Bookworm, that when you look at the title, if you say the redshifting web, well, I don't know what redshifting is. I don't know what, is redshifting kind of web, but in fact, if you give up the idea of innate incomprehension and start with the idea that you already in some way know everything, you will discover that your intuitions tell you things immediately, that redshifting comes simply from a different sphere of language than web. So immediately in the title, there's a complexity and a simplicity, and that is characteristic, as it turns out, of these poems, and you find that out by just looking. You might for a moment think, if you don't know, that redshifting is a term, say, from the natural world, that that it's a, something, say, a web that forms around the needles of a cactus. That turns out not to be true. But again, it is useful because these poems tell us about the degree to which we don't know the world, both in large, the very complicated concretions of science and of cosmology, and in small, what we don't know until we look about the tiny things. So it seems to me that this is a poetry that is open to discovery simply by looking, that the poems are not holding back information from you. In fact, there's a glossary and notes of sorts, which indicates that there's a almost simplicity about the terms being used. They are not being used to threaten you.
That's right. If anything, the notes in the back are kind of like hints that I hope a sensitive reader will pursue and follow. I like to bring different realms of knowledge together. Our society is extremely specialized. Physicists have their particular vocabulary. Weavers have their particular vocabulary. Those are, for instance, two sets of vocabularies, two worlds that interest me very much, that have been a strong part of my own history and my own background. And I see one of the things I like to do as a poet is to bring them together. Like it or not, we live in a very complex world. And part of the intricacy is to explore in what Western, philosophy calls epistemology, the idea of the one and the many. I have another book titled Archipelago, and there the image is that the shape of each poem can be like an island. And yet, if you read across 60 different poems, each poem has its different shape, its different configuration, but they're all islands. They connect somehow below surface. So one of the things I like to do is use very strong visual images to catch a reader's attention, to make a reader see things in a way that might be startling and even challenging. And that's a way to sort of draw a reader in. A reader doesn't necessarily have to know, like you said, exactly the meaning of redshift. And a reader might just say, oh, the color red. And yet that's already embodied in how we look at the world and why something is red or why something is blue. So there's a play between surface and depth, how the world appears to be, how it actually is, how it transforms. These are all really crucial issues in my work.
I noticed as I began to go through the poems, first the new poems in the book by my guest Arthur C., that the poems, the lines are not necessarily consecutive so much as they seem parallel. And I wanted to start perhaps by reading one of these poems that is constructed along parallel lines. So I'm going to ask Arthur C. to read part of the opening sequence of the book. The poem is called Before Completion, and it seems to me that the second section might be an example of that.
If I can talk a little background about the poem, the title Before Completion is a reference to the I Ching, which is the ancient Chinese divination text. And the first section explains that the etymology in Chinese of the character I is a pictograph of the chameleon. And that, I think, is kind of extraordinary, meaning a chameleon can change its appearance depending on its environment, depending on its temperature, and we know even depending on its emotion. If it feels fear, for instance, the skin of a chameleon will change color. And so here's this image of the one and the many again, that the appearances in the world can be shifting, but it's still a chameleon. The other thing I want to say is that in the I Ching, if you throw the coins, for instance, you can do a plant method, a Yarrow method, but if you throw the coins, for instance, you generate a series of six solid or broken lines. And in ancient Chinese cosmology, the yin, the female energy, can turn into the yang, the male energy, and vice versa. They transform into each other. And so one of the things I was experimenting with in this poem, in terms of its structure, which is six sections, that I wanted to create a kind of a hexagram, a kind of archetypal pattern of energy. And so there are solid or sort of like very block-like stanzas, which are equivalent to yang male lines. And there are sections that are very broken and more or less shattered that are more equivalent to the yin, to the female lines. Here's section two. Where does matter end and space begin? Blue jays eating suet. Juggling three crumpled newspaper balls wrapped with duct tape. Tasseling corn. The gravitational bending of light. We're dying. Stringing a coral necklace. He drew his equations on butcher paper, vanishing in sunlight, sobbing. She folded 500 paper cranes and placed them in a basket, sleeping in his room in a hammock. They drew a shell to represent zero. Red persimmons. What is it like to catch up to light? He threw before completion, six in the third place, nine in the sixth.
Arthur C. reading from his sequence Before Completion, that was the second section. Now, some of the lines are going to repeat in other poems and gain contexts. These are almost as if they're units to be rearranged. And I noticed that in the suite of poems that begins the collection, which are all of the new poems, these phrases do not just repeat within individual sequences. they appear again and again, so that what looked like an individual poem or even a section of an individual poem will repeat elsewhere. Is that part of the expansion feeling that you're creating in these poems?
Absolutely. You can think of each line as a very discrete kind of unit. And yet I think each discrete unit can be extremely profound. Like, "Where does matter end and space begin?" was actually a sentence said to me by George Zweig, who is one of two contemporary physicists who discovered the quark. And for instance, you know, years ago people thought the atom was the fundamental particle of the universe, and then it turned out people thought it was the nucleus, and then they thought it was the proton, and then they think it's the quark. You know, so just a line like that is very discrete, very precise, but it's very resonant and has huge implications. And so I like to take very specific things and use them as material to create something much larger. And as you say, some of those lines reappear in the context later in another shattered section, for instance, of Before Completion. And it's as if philosophically nothing is destroyed, so to speak, that all the energy of the universe is there. It comes back. It can come back identically. It can come back transformed, but it's still there. I mean, that's back to Einstein. And yet, the poem sort of doesn't end. If you read the suite of five sequences that open the redshifting web, there are certain images that spill over, or that you think you might be done with in one poem, and then in three sequences later, here it is, and it comes back in another incarnation. And that is something that's kind of, I think, subconscious on my part as a poet, meaning I think I have these materials that I work with, and like music, I think I like to extend it and bring them back like a certain kind of melody, so that each time they come back, they enrich what's there, and they're part of the larger pattern, the larger fabric that's there.
Well, it reminded me of some of the things that Ernst Fenollosa says about ideograms, that they are composed almost like a schist of joined images, and that in addition, when they're placed in different contexts, they take on different meanings, different colorations, and different inflections. Is your poetry influenced by the Chinese character?
Absolutely. I feel that I got my own training, my apprenticeship, through translating classical Chinese poets, Li Bo, Du Fu, Wang Wei. When I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, I translated a lot of those classical Chinese poems. I also studied Mandarin intensely every day for 2 years. The sound of Chinese, the sense that it can, that it's a tonal language, influences, I think, how I read, how I even approach and use the English language, and the structure of a Chinese ideogram. Not that all characters can be broken down into concrete sort of images. I think the structure of the ideogram is maybe more complex than Fenollosa recognized. But that kind of bringing together and complexity in language, I think, is something very dear to me and something that I love to explore and run with as a poet. But again, and even the tension to silence, I think, is very clear in classical Chinese poetics, where you might have a five-character line like Wang Wei, Kung Shan, Bu Zhen Rin, has a kind of asymmetry. There are two characters, a caesura, and then three characters, and it's empty mountain, not sea man. I'm giving you a very skeletal sort of translation of that, but right away you're, as a reader, presented with a paradox. What is an empty mountain? And then there's a silence. And then the Nazi man is very simple, but in its context, it's transformed. That's something you can see that's a very strong, that tradition is very, it's a river, I think, that runs through my poetry.
It's interesting that you mention silence, because I was thinking that in the lyric poetry appearing in America now, there is a poetry of ecstasy and rapture, and then a poetry of wonder and awe. And I guess the distinction I'm trying to make is that the ecstatic poem thrills and vibrates in certain ultra frequencies. There's a kind of rattling of mind, of falling apart. In your poetry, there's a certain rapture is there, but it has the silence that wonder instills or awe. It seems to be wrapped in contemplation.
I think that's true. Many people have seen Zen Buddhism as an influence, and a well-known contemporary poet actually asked me, well, when I met her, she said, gee, how long have you been studying Zazen? And I don't consider myself a Buddhist at all, and I've never done Zazen. But again, the ideas of sort of meditation, of clarity, of stillness are very, very important. And I like to think of the image of a Zen garden, for instance, Ryoanji in Kyoto, where stones are set in a sea of raked gravel. And part of the power is to sink much of the stone below surface and make a viewer feel how much is missing. But that weight of the stone that's sort of buried in the sand exerts a very strong influence. And that's part of the silence of the poem. It can charge and transform what's there. I guess the other thing I want to say is I think my poetry actually has an ecstatic element to it. The lines can appear to be laid out parallel, like you said, but, you know, even in mathematics, parallel lines touch in the infinite. And that's one of the things I'm after, too, is with that sense of silence, that the line or what that line says can sort of have an extension and stop, and it's like a kind of limit to language. And then another line can appear to be like traveling in a different plane, maybe askew, but ultimately in the infinite they are touching.
The other quality of these lines that I notice is that they are, rather than generated by cause and effect, they are simultaneous. All of the lines of the poem are on display at once, and it's as if the reading of the poem involves reading it and then looking at it from something like an aerial view and then going back and wandering in amongst the lines and seeing what perspectives and what shadows they cast on each other.
I think that's true. Synchronicity, this idea of simultaneity, but a kind of deeper, meaningful, and you could even say sort of acausal synchronicity is something that my work is struggling to sort of find how the world is moving below surface. On the one hand, we live in a world which I think we're sort of battered every day by media, by events happening all over the world, and it's hard to sort of make sense of them. And in that respect, that's maybe part of what I'm working at, a kind of, maybe there's an element of social critique there or response to the world that we live in, that there are just so many things happening at once. How do we know what's essential and what's inessential? How do we know what is actually causing something else? But, you know, even if you look at Western philosophy, like the billiard ball theory, which is, you know, like a cue ball hits this ball and that, you know, Hume will say there is no causality there, that the skeptics will say it's sort of like a coincidence. You may see the one ball hit the other, but it doesn't necessarily mean the other one has to. It's a kind of concomitance. And again, I'm sort of taking that skeptical, philosophical idea or perception and trying to work with it, because I think ultimately poetry has to, we're searching for some kind of larger pattern in order, and I think it's not necessarily the pattern we think is there. So one of the things my poems like to do is try and pursue that sense of synchronicity. And I think it's a way of opening ourselves up to the world, too. If you're following a straightforward sort of narrative line, you can think of, oh, I'm headed in this particular direction. But when you lose that sense of orientation, it's more troubling, it's more terrorizing, in a sense, but it also makes more possible. And when you realize anything can sort of happen anywhere, I think that has a lot to do with how a poem of mine works, that I'm trying to get a reader to sort of see the world anew, and that's one of the ways I have to do it, and at first the poem can be disorienting.
I'm speaking to Arthur C., the poet Well, his collected poems thus far have recently been published by Copper Canyon Press under the title The Red Shifting Web. I thought I would end this conversation by giving you the choice of a poem to conclude with. Can you...
I'd like to read a challenging poem. It's the first section of the title poem, The Red Shifting Web, which is a poem in 9 sections, and so obviously you can't see the scope of it, but I'd like to read just the first section to give a sense of what is being initiated. It has a history of bronze mirrors in the poem, but the poem itself has to do with mind, imagination, and consciousness. Here it is, The Red Shifting Web. The dragons on the back of a circular bronze mirror swirl without end. I sit and am an absorbing form. I absorb the outline of a snowy owl on a branch, the rigor mortis in a hand. I absorb the crunching sounds when you walk across a glacial lake with aquamarine ice heaved up here and there 20 feet high. I absorb the moment a jeweler pours molten gold into a cuttlefish mold and it begins to smoke. I absorb the weight of a pause when it tilts the conversation in a room. I absorb the moments he sleeps holding her right breast in his left hand and know it resembles glassy waves in a harbor in descending spring light. Is the mind a mirror? I see pig carcasses piled up from the floor on a boat docked at Wanshen, and the cook who smokes inadvertently drops ashes into soup. I absorb the stench of burning cuttlefish bone, and as moments coalesce, see to travel far is to return.
Arthur C., reading the opening section of The Red Shifting Web. Thank you very much for joining us, Arthur.
Thank you.
I am recording this interview at the Lannan Foundation's Literary Library in Santa Fe. The engineer is me, and so I apologize for any unusual tones that you're picking up from the room and being outside of a radio studio. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel, development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.